podcast is part of the Cannabis Media Collective. To enjoy all of the podcasts within the collective, just go to your favorite streaming app or site and subscribe to the Cannabis Media Collective. For more info, check out distinctmedia.ca.
The Periodic Effects Cannabis Business and Science Podcast is brought to you by Periodic Edibles, the cannabis caramel company, available in Oregon.
You, in fact, had a comment you wanted to make, Richard.
Well, it's rather moved on. I mean, I was just going to say, I can't imagine why anyone should think it was an ethical problem. I could see why they might think it was a
Hello, welcome back, and thank you for joining us again. If this is your first time joining, my name is Wayne, and I'll be your host for the podcast. I own and operate an edible business in the Oregon rec market, and the Periodic Effects podcast will focus on the business and science of cannabis. We upload new episodes every Monday night, bringing you an insider look at successful business operators and the leading edge cannabis science research. If you're operating in the cannabis industry or a consumer looking to learn how cannabis can help you, this is your podcast. All right, this week's episode is with Katie Stem, CEO of Peak Extracts, an Oregon processor. Katie and I recorded this on February 7th, 2019. And Katie and Peak have been operating in the cannabis market for a while in Oregon, started in the medical market. I think she said 2014, got their rec license in 2017, have grown in quite a few shops, possibly looking at other states to expand. And we kind of cover the whole gambit of, you know, running an extract and edible company. They do both around, you know, marketing, branding, sales, distribution, the internal operations. And we get into some other key things that Katie brought up that kind of made me aware of some new things, talking about seasonal swings in sales. So starting to identify some of those trends that are happening in cannabis, GW Pharmaceuticals trying to trademark CBD, the name and not necessarily the molecule, but probably also that as well. You know, the farm bill we've been discussing in past episodes, what that might look like. We get into a little bit of that. And then cannabis and CBD in general. You know, Katie does have a lot of science background and experience. And so we kind of hit on a little bit about cannabis or CBD being a drug under the FDA or a supplement, possibly under the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms regulating. So a lot of unknowns. Really enjoyed this conversation with Katie. I think you as well. And we'll jump straight into it. Here's Katie from Peak Extracts. Katie Stem joining us today from Peak Extracts in Portland, Oregon. Katie, you guys are in Portland. Is that where your operation facility is? Is that correct?
Yes, we are. We're in close in Portland.
All right. And so, yeah, I'll do a little longer in the intro and the introduction to this and give some more details on you and the business. But when I start with guests for listeners, I always just ask, when people ask, what do you do? What do you tell them?
Well, I'm the CEO, but I do a lot of extraction work and formulation for Peak. And I also run a medical practice, and I do whatever's needed, really. I tend to do about 25 different things based on any given day.
Yeah. Yeah. In the cannabis industry right now, wearing a lot of different hats. You still run your, is that your Chinese medicinal practice?
Yeah. I have an acupuncture and Chinese herbal medicine practice in Portland that I've been running for 8 years now.
8 years. Okay. Yeah. I want to definitely get in the background. I know you've used some of that knowledge and experience to develop some of your products, which I think is awesome, and the focus you guys have on the science. For a little bit more context for listeners, what year did you start Peak? And then how many people do you have on the team, and how many retailers are you in Oregon?
So we started officially in 2014, and we sold our first chocolate bar shortly thereafter. We'd been making chocolate for many years prior to that, but that was when we entered the medical market.
Okay.
And then we converted in 2016 to recreational.
2016. Okay.
Yeah. We were the first edibles maker licensed in Oregon.
Yeah, I remember that. You were first on the shelf.
That was a crazy time. We were literally banging down our doors asking for edibles.
Yeah.
And so to your second question, we have about 10 people on staff. It varies seasonally. In the busy season, we go up to about 12, and at as few as six, but pretty much it's between 8 and 10.
Okay. And then how many retailers are you guys in?
We're in about 150 right now.
50. Nice. Good size. You said it variables seasonally. Have you noticed, is that around the edibles? I know you do an extract and a topical as well. Have you noticed a trend in those sales where it seasonally peaks in a certain time and not in another?
Yeah, it seems to be more in summer. I think people are having more fun and, you know, playing outside and hiking and doing more recreational things in the spring and summer. And then it tends to slow down pretty heavily in the winter. And I think that's mostly because of retailers wanting to get rid of their inventory because of the way it's taxed. They don't want to be full taxed on their inventory that's sitting around on the shelves in December.
Yeah. It's so interesting in this market right now, trying to see like seasonal trends, right? That's the thing in different industries. And would that be a factor in cannabis? And we're learning all these things right now. We don't know until, we're still only a few years into it. So that's cool that you guys have started to identify some of those. Did you roll out the chocolate first in the rec market in 2016?
Yeah, we rolled out with the Rescue Rub and the chocolate. And then we brought the extracts back on in 2018.
Okay. And what were those early initial months or even 6 months like when you were one of the first available and rolled those products out? I mean, you said people are banging on your door trying to get the product. How were you managing supply with production? And I got to imagine you're like, well, I got to scale. There's all this demand. What were those early days like?
Yeah, it was tricky because although I will say that we had the advantage of being in the early, they called it something interesting. It was like early release.
Early sales they early did or sales. Something. Yeah.
We were allowed to sell a small amount. We couldn't do a full size bar, but we could do 15 milligram medallions for the first 4 or 5 months there from June through November.
Okay.
And so we did a ton of those. And then when we converted to the fully recreational market, we only had one chocolate bar at the time, and that was the blue, and we ran out of that immediately. And so the biggest problem at the time was not production, because we had that pretty much on lock, but it was really waiting for the test results to come back. And that was, between a 2 and 4 week wait in certain situations. And then if you didn't get the potency right, you had to send it back. And at that point they had changed the pesticide testing rules for extracts. And so we were having some failures. Everyone says they don't use pesticides, but then when it comes down to it, a lot of our stuff failed. And so we had to throw that out and change sources and start with new oil. And that was a bit of a headache, but we did have times when we didn't have enough product to give to customers. And then we worked out the kinks and were able to scale up.
Yeah. Or have you been making your own oil to infuse your edibles and everything from the very beginning?
Yeah, that was how we started. In 2014, we bought an extractor. It was a benchtop, really small model.
Oh, yeah.
And we scaled up in 2016 and got our current machine.
Okay. And so I think maybe we could hit on a little bit of your background now as well. But, with making your own oil, I could see an edible company, supplying oil from someone else, putting it in their products. But, I mean, that is a huge undertaking and expertise that you have to make extracts like that. Did you have previous experience to be able to do that? And whether you did or not, what were some of those initial like roadblocks or bottlenecks that were like difficult to push through?
Yeah, I had a lot of experience with extraction. I did my first cannabis extraction in college using hexane. I took a ton of chemistry in college, and I worked in laboratory science for about 10 years before I went to acupuncture school. And so most of my specialty was in neuroscience, but I did a ton of pharmacology research, which involved a lot of isolation of compounds and then formulating them into drugs or, delivery methods for animals or human subjects. And so I was really familiar with what it takes to dose something correctly, make a serial dilution, that kind of thing, and also do basic extractions of active constituents. And so I was familiar with hydrocarbon, ethanol, and CO2 extraction before I even started doing cannabis.
Yeah.
And so it just seemed like kind of a natural thing for me to explore. But that said, there was a lot of things I had to learn when we started doing cannabis extracts, because there's no data on it. Everything else I'd ever done, I could look up the studies, I could look up all of the protocols, and there was a clear guide of how to do it and do it well. And that was not there for cannabis. And so there was some trial and error, and I definitely made some mistakes early on.
Yeah. So yeah, a lot of experience in extracting. When you initially were working with cannabis, and I'm assuming looking at the outside market, you know, that's, I mean, that expertise was hard in the early days of cannabis to find and have, where it was still, you know, maybe people that were in the gray market that were coming over. How did you view just the landscape in general of extracts and what was out on the market? Was there some crazy products, crazy stories of stuff people were putting out? I've heard some bad ones of explosions, you know, especially around butane. But what were those early days like in the extract market?
Well, I had a couple of friends that were my medical growing colleagues that were experimenting with butane. And I always found that very scary because they were not doing it safely. In fact, one of my friends blew his eyebrows off.
Jeez.
That was my first experience. And, you know, butane can be done safely, and it's a great solvent, but I've always been really nervous about the explosive hazard. And furthermore, it's a nightmare in terms of disposing of the waste material. You have to incinerate it, and whereas CO2, you just compost it, and the farms are happy to take it back. And so I was weary. A lot of the products I saw on the market were, if they were CO2, they were often rancid by the time they got to the consumers because they weren't properly handled. And so I wasn't one of those people that tried a lot of the CO2 products when they first came out. I stuck to edibles and flower. And then now that we have our own product, I use it because I know exactly what's gone on with it. But I still am a little bit leery because I know all of the ways that you can cheat, and I know all the ways that things can go wrong. And once you have a large batch that goes wrong, there's not really a clear path to getting rid of it or remediating it into something that would be safe. And so I think people tend to just put it on the market anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, you hope that's caught in the testing and, you know, the protocols we have here. But if, you know, there's always ways around things, and yeah, it's scary. I think that's where in the early days too, you have a lot of companies online, and there hasn't been that time to kind of filter out or build the trust of which companies are doing it right. And even 3 years in, it's still like that. A lot of new companies coming online. They do the best in the regulations, but, you know, obviously there's always gaps there. So when you started, so the background in science, extraction, what made you get into cannabis initially? It sounds like you were heavily involved in the research field. I think I saw in your profile you worked for Oregon Health Science University. How did you make the jump to either trying cannabis or deciding to start a business around cannabis? Because I always think that's such a huge leap, and especially just 3 or 4 years ago, it just wasn't nearly as accepted as it is now, I feel like.
So I got into cannabis in 2004. I got my medical card. My gastroenterologist here, when I moved to Oregon, suggested that I try cannabis. And it was really helpful to manage my symptoms. And so it was a progression of me deciding that I needed to figure out how to control my health, because in my mid-20s, I was really sick and I wasn't particularly functional. And so even though I had studied and prepared and worked in labs for so long, I just wasn't healthy enough to go through the motions of getting a PhD at that point. And so I figured that I should try doing Chinese medicine, because that was going to help me along the way. I felt like getting a degree in Chinese medicine, I would end up being healthier than I was at the beginning, as opposed to something like medical school or a PhD program, where I felt like it would make me sicker just because of the pressures and the lack of resources to help me heal. And it worked out pretty well. I graduated from Chinese medical school in 2010, and I was healthier than when I started. And I started my practice, and cannabis was still a really big part of managing my relapses. And so when it became clear that Oregon was going to go rec, I decided that I wanted to try it out, because I had already gained all these skills in strain-specific chocolates and formulations, and I already knew how to do extractions because of my lab background. And so I decided to, you know, invest in the small machine and try to make it into a part-time gig. Of course, there's no way it could be a part-time gig now.
Yeah.
But it's been a really fun journey.
Yeah. So I love that story. And I think those are so powerful of going on this journey to solve this problem that you have in your life, and then how it all comes together and ends up to developing into a business and cannabis is being legalized. When you first were trying cannabis in 2004, was there something specific you found helped with your Crohn's disease? And is Crohn's, like, is it always an ongoing thing, or are there certain flare-ups where you could be okay for a week and then something might hit you and it's kind of unpredictable?
Yeah, it's a relapsing remitting autoimmune disease. And so I'll have periods where I'm fairly stable or unhealthy, and then I'll have periods where I'm extraordinarily ill. And there are a lot of triggers that can be stress or diet or, you know, any number of things. And cannabis helps me function during my periods of flares by reducing the amount of pain that I'm in and reducing the number of bowel movements and controlling the inflammatory cascade. Because once it starts, it's like a fire. You know, I'll get one ulcer and then it'll spread to 50, and then I'll get infections. It's a drag, to say the least. And so what I discovered was that I was growing two different kinds of cannabis. I was growing Trainwreck and Blue Magoo, and Trainwreck made my nausea worse. It made my abdominal pain more obvious, like less possible to ignore. Mm-hmm. And the Blue Magoo was pretty much the opposite. I was able to eat, I was able to function, and I wasn't too foggy or stupid. And that allowed me to, you know, regain my ability to be a normal functioning member of society. And so I started experimenting with using that in an edible form, and it was fantastic. And so that was when it first dawned on me that the strain really did matter, and that I needed to figure out which strains were going to help me and which ones to avoid. And so then I started growing Blue Goo and other blueberry derivatives, like Sweet Tooth and what was my other favorite? Blueberry Cookies. And from that point, I just started to refine all of the different strains and what they did for me.
Did you find edibles to be more helpful in combating the Crohn's versus smoking?
I had to use a combination because edibles take so long.
Yeah.
And so when I'm having an acute flare, I need something as quickly as possible. And so that was where the vaporizer came in, vaporized flower. I like the edibles for the long curve of duration of action. And so, you know, I can use it for 6 hours and have it be in the background and not super disruptive. And also discreet. And also it was useful, the chocolate, especially because it's something that I don't have to mechanically digest. It just melts. And so it doesn't tend to irritate those smooth muscle spasms that happen with Crohn's flares.
Yeah, I think there's another piece to that with the edibles and melting in your mouth versus, you know, chewing it up and swallowing it. I think going tinctures kind of work that way, where they get in through the mucus glands, and I think they don't have to be metabolized in the liver in that scenario. So it's a little bit different and maybe a quicker onset when you let it melt. Yeah, so you're kind of getting both. If you swallow half of it and half of it kind of absorbs through the mucus glands, it can be maybe doubly effective for you.
Totally. Yeah. It bypasses that first pass hepatic metabolism.
Now for the strains, Trainwreck, you said wasn't as effective and maybe had some negative side effects, and you found Blue Magoo and some of those derivatives to be useful. Since that time, have you identified what it is about those specific strains, the ones that work for you that you look for now, whether it's, you know, potency, other cannabinoids, terpenes, or anything like that?
I think it's terpenes, but I'm not positive. Terpenes are so hard to tease apart. There's so many factors, and they're active at such a minute quantity that it's really hard for me to say one way or another exactly what chemicals are helping versus not. But I can tell you that I can tell by smell now.
Interesting.
And when we categorize things, we have 6 different categories. It's mostly based on genetics, but I can also determine how something's going to feel based on the smell of it and whether or not I'm going to like it.
Okay.
Based on the smell.
So it's almost like that smell is at least giving you a gut reaction or an instinct to what the profile might be. And it's kind of clicking like this feels right or this feels wrong.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because it wasn't until maybe 10 or 15 years ago that we discovered that there are taste receptors in your colon. And so that kind of blew my mind open in terms of how we get taste aversions to things and how we have affection for certain things. And I think that there's probably something to do with that in the way that I I identify the cannabis that works for me or not, because, you know, scent and taste are so similar, and it's such a visceral thing for me, literally. It's my organs. So.
Yeah, no, definitely is. And are all your products, I think I read you do a single strain for your chocolate bars and your pens as well. So it's is a specific strain and not like a mix or a distillate that's been from all these different sources that some people infuse with?
Absolutely.
Very cool.
Almost every single thing is single strain. The Rescue Rub is a blend. Because we found that it worked a little bit better if there was a diverse terpene profile.
Yeah.
And then we have one cartridge right now that's a blend of two different oils because it's jelly bean, but I wanted to combine it with CBD because the strain itself is meant to treat abdominal pain and cramps.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured it would be cool if we had extra CBD. So I combined it with another CBD strain that we really love, Corazon, and it works.
Okay. Yeah, I've almost been wondering the blends, you know, if you want to crossbreed two strains and you're getting these new genetics or a mix between the two, the hybrid, I wonder if you just took those two strains initially on their own and then put them together in an oil or an edible, if that would kind of be a similar effect or profile than the plant that would have been made from those two strains. I don't know if that's a stretch, or, but I've kind of wondered that, if it would have similar effects.
I totally think you're right. In fact, We played around with that a little bit. We did a test between Blue Dragon Desert Frost and Tangy Glue, because the Tangy Glue for me is one of those danger strains. You know, it's really, it's a sativa, but it's really heavy in the body and it tends to make me anxious.
Mm.
And so we were like, okay, what happens if we put three parts Blue Dragon, which is a really sedating indica CBD strain?
Yeah.
And it's actually delightful. And so we may end up playing around with that. I know that early in the rec days, people were doing that because CBD material was so scarce. Mm-hmm. So they would do AC/DC train wreck or something, or AC/DC headband. It was just literally headband and AC/DC mixed together in order to get something with higher CBD.
Huh.
And I think with CBD, that's a clever thing to do, because the genetics for CBD aren't quite diverse enough yet.
Yeah.
And so it would be a way to have a little bit more nuance in your experience and still have that CBD benefit.
Yeah, definitely. So with, you know, either using single strains or even potentially a blend, but you're really looking for the full spectrum, good terpene profiles, how do you go about sourcing your material from the farms, and what do you look for? And what, when you find something, you're like, okay, I want to buy this one, this can go into our products. Like, what does that flower look like to you?
Well, luckily, because Oregon has an absolute glut right now.
Yeah, a lot of options.
We have a lot of options. And so, you know, it's a given that right now we're going to be able to find really good, really high potency, fresh, terpene rich flower. And so we have the benefits of being able to say, all right, we want these specific strains or these specific profiles or these specific phenotypes. So, I mean, it's just a glut. We're so fortunate to be able to choose what we want. But we usually choose strains based on how they fit into the categories rather than vice versa. Or, you know, if people ask for it, that's another way that we choose them. Mm. We keep hearing about a strain, then we try to find it and put it into a product.
Do you find a lot of buyers are looking for that specifically, almost maybe even buying on the name basis of the strain and seeing that you have just that as the infusion source?
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them have name recognition, and some of it's that people have great experiences with them. Blue Dream is one that we had for, gosh, maybe a year and a half, and then we phased it out in favor of something else, and people were so mad. And I mean, the other one is fantastic too, the Blueberry Cough, but we're bringing the Blue Dream back because everyone missed it so much.
Yeah.
We came to rely on it for a very specific effect.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like sometimes you have something that's really working really well, but people don't, you know, you get stories here and there, especially some, you know, powerful ones if it's really helped somebody, but you don't really know until you change something or take it off. And then you get this wave of like, you know, frustration. It's like, oh, okay. Well, okay. I get it. We'll bring that back. Yeah, that's good to hear. Do you look for, you know, again, on the terpenes, I'm starting to wonder if outdoor flower versus your indoor is a better source to get a higher terpene profile. Have you noticed that at all?
Well, I think that it depends, obviously, on the farm. We have an indoor farm that we've gotten really high terpene levels from.
Okay.
But we've also seen outdoor farms. I think what we see most is that the outdoor farms tend to have a broader range of the different terpenes, whereas, you know, we have one farm that we work with that it seems like no matter what the flower is, we're always going to get a particular terpene. In this case, it's geranium. Hmm. And I don't know whether it's the nutrients they use or the growing conditions or the lights, but for some reason, every flower, whether it's Pineapple Express or Corazon or, you know, Fluffer Nutter, is always going to have geranial, which is not supposed to be a particularly dominant terpene in general, but it always shows up in their farm. Whereas some of the outdoor grows that we've worked with, we'll get different things.
Sure.
You know, terpenes that we don't see very often, and also minor cannabinoids that we don't see very often. And that's where I really love to play with those. Is, you know, we'll get a CBG of 12% in our extract, at which point I'm just thrilled because I'd love to see what the terroir will do to the plant.
Yeah, I really wonder that, how much it is the genetics versus the environment around terpenes or minor cannabinoids. I've heard that terpenes are kind of developed based on stressors, and it's kind of the plant's defense mechanism. So depending on the environment or what stresses it's under, it could produce different ones. And around minor cannabinoids, I mean, terpenes and minor cannabinoids I'm fascinated by right now. And I think we're going to see such an explosion in these different formulas and new cannabinoids coming out. You just mentioned CBG. Have you looked at or made products specifically outside of the normal, you know, THC or CBD categories for cannabinoids?
Well, since we're kind of stuck with the strain specific, and so some of our products have ended up with really high CBG percentages, and we love that. We just want to feature the plant, and so we haven't done that except if we know that it's going to happen because of a certain farm. We work with one farm because we know that their minor cannabinoid levels are going to be fascinating.
Yeah.
And they'll end up throwing CBD in places that we didn't think it would be either. It's really cool.
Yeah. Do you think customers are... Is there too much of an education gap still? If you made a CBG product that was high in that, or even like some of these other minor cannabinoids, THCV, do you think it'd be a super fine, narrow connoisseur group that would actually appreciate that and know about it? And the rest of the customer base is still just getting their heads around, you know, just the THC and CBD right now?
I think that's actually a pretty big driver of people who purchase our products because, you know, there's another couple of companies that do the blast that's just THC,
right?
And that's at a cheaper price point than us. And
isolated.
So,
yeah,
most of our demographic are people who are interested in exploring something a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I hear a lot that the CBG levels specifically are what get people interested, and the really high terpene levels.
Yeah.
And I know at least in the Crohn's community, people look for THCV all the time because it's been established so obviously to be beneficial.
Mm, yeah. I'd love to know more about the rescue rub, the topical that you make. With your background in Chinese medicine, what did you do to develop that product that takes it beyond just, you know, an infusion of your THC or CBD that you have in most topicals? What other angles did you use or things did you integrate into that?
Well, it's kind of funny because I went about it the total opposite way. I took topicals in school. We did a long semester course of topical formulations, and topicals are a really big thing in Chinese medicine. And so I developed this cream that I called Burnside Balm that has 12 different Chinese herbs, and it's based on a formula that's around 2,000 years old, and it's for blunt force trauma from sticks.
Oh, yeah.
Which I thought was kind of hilariously specific. But it, you know, it's for martial artists that are practicing on fields using bats, basically. And so it's meant for trauma, bruising, lacerations, that kind of thing. And so I put it into a cream base, a coconut and shea butter, and I was using it in my practice for massage and for treating arthritis. And one of my friends, I'd already been making chocolates for several years at that point. One of my friends asked me why I hadn't put cannabis in some my cream.
Yeah.
And I felt really stupid because it totally hadn't occurred to me. And so that's how Rescue Rub was a thing. It was already a cream for 6 years before I ever put cannabis into it.
Yeah.
And of course it works way better now that there's cannabis in it. because cannabis is also a Chinese herb that was used to treat pain. And so that was my plan. And, you know, it's special because it's got all of those herbs, inflammation and pain. And also it has a couple of Chinese herbs that are meant to help it penetrate the muscle layer. Mm. And so it, given the potency, it works better than most of the products out there. Mm.
So yeah, I wanted to kind of go over to the business side, and I think, you know, I talked a little bit about the glut in the market right now, and Oregon just being such a super competitive state with the lower barrier to entry, which is great in one facet. It allows people to enter, you know, maybe with less capital or try a business that they wouldn't have been able to do in another state. The downside is you have a lot of companies, and we're dealing with that right now. As you're scaling up in those initial days, and when we went rec in 2016 and you're having all those sales, we noticed, you know, that window lasted for a while. It was nice. And then it kind of went through this middle plateau. And now we're in this phase where retailers are just, they have so many vendors knocking on their door. Nobody new really wants to talk with you. And it's very difficult. I wonder, how did you balance scaling up your production and size and capabilities to meet demand in the kitchen for, you know, chocolates, extracts, and your topical, while trying to balance that with the outside demand and how that would change and adjust? Was that a struggle? Are you still struggling with that? How do you kind of look at that?
Yeah, it took a while to settle on what kind of par we needed. Mm. And I think it's even more complicated now with changes in packaging regulations. And so it's kind of a nightmare. I mean, I'm yeah. You know, it's like we get everything under control and we have enough inventory on hand to be comfortable. And then we get a bulletin from the OLCC saying that we need to change something on the labels. And then, oh, we've got to relabel everything. And so it just never feels like we've got it figured out. But it was just being regular order volume and then making sure that we had enough to scale up at every moment, and, you know, navigating that with not having enough storage space, because yeah. You know, who can afford to have a giant warehouse where they house enough inventory to survive for 4 months? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think that would be sensible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a hard balance of how much do you over invest basically to overproduce, planning for that increase, and then you hope it comes. And a great problem is if it comes more than you expected, but then you can't keep up with demand. And I've just noticed that in the cannabis industry right now is constant struggle with all the changes and everything else that goes on. How are you thinking about you know, future plans or new states potentially? Are you looking at going into other states outside of Oregon, just staying in Oregon? How do you think about that?
Yeah, we're looking at other states. I'm the most interested in Michigan.
Oh yeah.
I spent several years in Minnesota when I was younger, and my partner, my girlfriend and my business partner is from Michigan. And so there's things drawing us there. You know, that the fact that we'll have to have a completely redundant factory is a barrier in multiple ways, but it's also an advantage. It allows you to cater to that market completely rather than trying to, you know, force our Oregon values or our Oregon tastes on a new market. Mm-hmm. But that's definitely something we're looking at. We're also looking at nationwide expansion into the hemp space.
Okay. Yeah, we definitely have to stay in contact. I grew up in Michigan. A couple of our employees did as well. We got friends, family there, and they just legalized recreational. And they're trying to get their bearings about the medical program right now. So we're just really watching and wait until there's a little more consistency to maybe pursue that a little further. But huge opportunity there. And obviously grew up there. So I love Michigan. Great state. Yeah. Have you thought about, so like you said, the redundant system there, it's very capital intensive. You have to build out a whole new team. You can customize it more, which is nice, maybe hopefully on the marketing and branding and sales side of it. But for other states, have you considered like the licensing your IP, a deal like that? Or do you really look at it like we would want to own the infrastructure and the operation of it?
Yeah. So from a legal perspective, I'm a little bit nervous about licensing IP.
Yeah.
That seems to be something that 280E directly contemplates as a violation. And so this is more philosophical. Because, you know, it's, you can't have direct money flowing back and forth from two cannabis companies. So that's interstate commerce, right? And then there's also this idea of, okay, so if we're teaching someone how to do cannabis, for lack of a better descriptor, then that also could be a violation of interstate commerce. If everybody's profiting from it. So we're nervous about that. And also, you know, we didn't get where we are by not being control freaks. Especially around processing to final product. So it would take the right team of people to produce our extracts for us to trust that that was what we wanted to do. And so, yeah, I mean, I would love to have an easier way than to just deliver that. But I haven't wrapped my head around how that would look and still maintain enough control to be comfortable.
Yeah, such a big question right now. And because it's so fragmented, every state is completely different. How you expand, and you see companies getting into four or five new states and going quickly. And that looks desirable in theory and on paper, but the logistics of that and managing that, I mean, that's a serious pocketbook you have to cover just on the potential legal side of what could happen. How are you, what do you think about the hemp market or the CBD market? Are you looking to do your current product line just in the CBD form? And would you sell that from your website and other stores outside of, you know, shops or dispensaries? How do you kind of look at the market as a whole and your plan to initially move into that?
Yeah, that is what we're looking at. I think we could bring the skills that we learned with cannabis into hemp. And try to keep some of this nuance and strain specificity as much as possible. And it just would be nice to be able to share it with the country rather than just having Oregon. Oregon is wonderful and I love it, but it's not a very big state. There's not a lot of people here compared to the rest of the country. And so we want to be competitive when these giant mega corporations start coming in. We want to be sure that we have something that we can hold on to. And I'm just not sure that just having Oregon, even if we have a really good presence here, if that's going to be enough to prevent us from getting totally suffocated.
Yeah, it's a huge question. In the hemp market, obviously, there's so much more flexibility and options there to have a presence in other places. And that's a huge question we're constantly asking ourselves is, you know, if there is interstate commerce or federal legalization and really big money moves in, I mean, you could see signs of it already. What do you think it is that you said not getting completely suffocated? What are the key factors or things that would allow you to not get suffocated in that moment? I mean, do you really think like is you got to get higher volume so your pricing can come down? Is it branding? Is it marketing? Distribution, be in as many stores as possible? Like how do you, what's your strategy, I guess, to hopefully prevent against that huge threat?
I have a few strategies, and I think one of them, my total bailout strategy is just being a trip hazard. What I like to think of it as is that it would be cheaper for them to buy us than to just kill us. Obviously, I'd love to keep doing what I do, but I have to face the fact that someone, you know, like the Starbucks model where they came in and they underpriced everyone until they went away and then they took over. That's going to happen. And so I think the real pragmatic approach is just to make sure that we're really efficient and that we have a following and that we can survive with a pretty minimal market reach if we need to for a while. And I mean, right now, the main barrier for these people coming in is 280E. And secondarily, it's being able to get licensed to Oregon because there's now accepting new license applications and the waiting list 12 to 14 months. And so if someone wanted to be a processor in Oregon, they should buy another processor's license rather than wait 14 months. And so we just want to make sure that we can be sustainable in any situation. And I'm not sure how that's going to look. It's pretty scary to think about people being able to spend $100 million just to crush us.
You see some of the numbers on the M&A that's mergers and acquisitions happening right now, or people, bigger money buying companies, and some of the numbers are just huge. And we look at that and it's like, how can we compete? And philosophically, we kind of have the same thing. It's like, we're building this company. We love our team. We want to keep doing this. But I think that's important to have that as a plan B, C, or D as an option, setting yourself up that way, because sometimes, you know, I don't know what the answer is. Can you stay small and local and really have that brand? Or eventually is like, you just can't compete with this unless you raise who knows how much money, and let alone the expertise you have to pull that off at scale. It's just such a hard question to answer, but I really like that positioning as another option. Having options, I guess, is very important right now, and being flexible.
Yeah, and I think it's important to do what you and I are doing right now, which is to market ourselves as experts in a field that doesn't have very many, and that, you know, we know things about how to run a business in this industry that are not known outside of it, because it's super unique. Mm-hmm. And so we need to leverage our knowledge in a way that keeps us here.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you heard any rumblings around the hemp CBD? I did a couple podcast episodes, my most recent ones, with someone that said they thought maybe the infused products category with hemp or CBD might be completely moved to the pharmaceutical model because of GW Pharmaceuticals' rollout of their product, and that it would potentially could just push out any small to medium sized businesses. Have you seen anything about that or heard anything around that?
I know they tried, and yeah, I'm sure they're going to try again. Their attempt to patent CBD,
yeah,
to trademark CBD as just a word and as an acronym, failed. Mm. And I'm hoping that, because people like Mitch McConnell are in it for the growers of hemp as well,
yeah,
that we'll have a little bit of protection besides what you believe is a British company. So maybe they'll get a little bit of infighting. I'm certainly worried about it.
Yeah.
As long as we can keep it in the food supplement category rather than the pharmaceutical category, mm-hmm, then it might go the way of like red yeast rice, where we have to start calling it something else. And everyone was poised for that. You know, if we couldn't say CBD anymore, we would have to call it cannabis hemp extract or something that was more vague. Because they can't really control, if hemp is legal, they can't control us taking things out of and putting it into things.
Yeah.
Unless make us test it for CBD and then ban everything that has CBD. That would be logistically very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how they passed the farm bill and, you know, no real clear regulations or anything around it, but it seems like a bunch of people are kind of off to the races, and it's wide open now, and it's like, I don't know how this thing might end up going. It's still a lot to be seen.
Yeah, I mean, it does make me nervous, especially with the edibles.
Yeah.
Even though I think they're fantastic and CBD would be widely consumed, it does make me nervous that they might just take the rug out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Katie, I appreciate your time so much. I really love, your focus on the science and your background in Chinese medicine. Bringing that to your products is just a beautiful synergy of two different worlds or industries coming together. Not really different, I think, but, you know, as a product offering to people and patients. One question I hit on before we close out, for listeners, if there's any opportunities, if you're looking to hire people currently, or maybe any outside partners, whether it's around marketing or design or anything like that, currently?
Yeah, we're actually looking for a couple of people to make chocolate.
Oh, cool.
So feel free to do a contact form on our website, peakextracts.com. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be ramping up for the summer busy season. So.
All right. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes and mention that for listeners. That's great. And then the last thing I always ask is, where can people find you? Website, socials, anywhere you want to send them?
Yeah, Instagram at Peak Extracts, and our website, if you want to find some retail stores and contact us through there.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thanks again, Katie, for joining us. Again, really just appreciate the time, your story, sharing that with us and listeners. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a joy.
All right, that was the episode. Thank you for tuning in and listening again. If you have a second or two, please leave us a rating and review on iTunes. We would really appreciate it. And also subscribe there. If you haven't, subscribing will get you episodes immediately when they come out. Normally there's a few hour lag if you're not subscribed. So if you're always looking for them on Monday, we will normally upload around 3 p.m., 4 p.m. Pacific time on Mondays. And we upload new episodes every Monday night of every week. So like always, we'll be back next week with another episode, and thank you again for listening this week. We'll talk next time.
The ideas presented in this podcast are meant for general informational purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. The Periodic Effects podcast, Periodic Edibles, and all affiliated subsidiaries disclaim any liability for any damages arising out of reliance on the information presented. Please consult licensed professionals for any medical, legal, or business advice.
This podcast was brought to you by the Cannabis Media Collective. The media contributors within the Cannabis Media Collective do our very best to remain as accurate as possible, but take no responsibility for any inaccurate details or facts. If a story interests you, we're glad to have brought it to your attention, but please take the time to research the details for yourself.